Welcome to Hour 2 of the Global Research News Hour. I'm Steve Lindman. I am so delighted and honored to have Michael Parenti on. I had Michael on another program that I hosted some months back. And, Michael, it's great to have you back. I think everybody
Hello,
listening, it's terrific having you. I can't imagine anybody listening doesn't know who you are. But if somebody just arrived from another planet, let me give them a little idea of your illustrious background. You've been at what you're doing for many, many, many years. You're an internationally known political scientist, an award-winning author and lecturer. You've written many, many books. I've read most of them. They're on my shelf. Democracy for the Few in its 8th edition, Super Patriotism, Inventing Reality, one of the earliest books on the state of the media, the way it is, the media that we all know and love to hate, at least people who listen to this program, and your newest book, which is a reader called Contrary Notions, the Michael Parenti Reader, and you're also one of the country's leading progressive political analysts, social critics, anti-war activists. And Michael, so much going on. We've got a new president coming in about 9 weeks, if my math is right. We've got a terrible financial / economic debacle going on. We've got illegal wars that are still raging. So much that we can talk about. And pick your topic and let's jump right in. When you hear music come on, it means they're going to take a commercial break. So I'll interrupt and then we'll come back. But which one shall we start on?
Well, whatever you wish to start.
I always want to go in the direction my guests want to go in.
Well, let me talk about. I'm writing an article right now called "Capitalism's Apocalypse," and
I love the title.
Well, it's about the claims that modern corporate capitalists or moneyed interests have made, you know, for a couple of centuries, namely that capitalism brings us democracy. And it brings us prosperity. Well, as far as prosperity goes, most of the world is capitalist and becoming increasingly capitalist, and most of the world is poor and becoming increasingly poor. The number of people living in poverty today is growing at a faster rate than the world's population. So poverty is spreading even as wealth concentrates, and there's a relationship between the two. I mean, the way I become rich is by getting you to create more and more value with your labor, which I can then accumulate in my own coffers. And so that's the way the slave owner lives in such opulence is by having slaves who work from dawn to dusk and for subsistence, or the feudal lord and the serfs, and so it goes. So corporate capitalism does not really bring us the prosperity that it claims to be bringing us. And I should also point out that throughout much of history, over the last 200 years, down to this very day, this last election, the moneyed interest, the powerful corporate interest, were not propagators of democracy. They resisted the expansion of the vote. They resisted the elimination of property qualifications. They've set up all sorts of new barriers. So we should not take their claims at face value and should present a critical eye to them. And I think we're going to have a break right now.
We're going to have a break. Everything you're saying would be emphasized and capitalized and underlined given what's going on today. Let's take a break and we'll come right back, Michael. Welcome back to the News Hour. I'm Steve Lindman. I'm on with Michael Parenti. Michael, I think by the way, when your article is finished, please send it to Michelle Chosedowski. So Global Research can post it. Anything you write is important information that people need to know about, and it'll get a lot of readership on globalresearch.ca.
Okay.
I think in Democracy for the Few, you showed how capitalism treats a very small segment of the population very well at the top, and it does it by extracting it from most of us, most of the rest of the population, the great majority of the people.
Yes, and this is why we should move from a liberal complaint about how stupid or bad or wrong something is to a radical analysis which gets to the root and tries to show how things are functioning in accordance to certain interests. Now, that's usually called, that's usually dismissed. Any approach in which you try to link immediate mishaps and problems to larger social relations is usually dismissed as, quote, conspiracy theory or paranoia or cynicism or the like. I call it reality. I mean, of course people can overdraw. Of course people can see imaginary links that aren't there. That's why you need empirical investigation to check it out. But take, for instance, Nancy Pelosi's comment that George Bush was a failure in everything he did, you know. I don't think so. I think George Bush is every bit as intelligent as a lot of his critics and enemies. In fact, more so, because they underestimate him. He got rid of the estates tax, which is the most progressive tax. That saved that fraction of 0.04 fraction of 1% of the very super richest people in the country. That saved them literally tens of billions of dollars every year they got. He doubled the defense budget, more than doubled the defense budget. He pursued a war that has led to multi-billion dollar, highly profitable contracts and the plundering of the public treasury. The U.S. Don't take my word for it. Listen to what the U.S. Department of Defense, the Pentagon, says. They say that about one-third of all the billions that have come through their way, they can't account for. They don't know what's happened to the money. Well, you don't lose tens of billions of dollars. You don't just misplace them, you know, on a counter or in some desk drawer. There's massive thievery going on. Bush has weakened all the environmental laws. He's weakened the enforcement and application of all sorts of environmental and human services laws. He's stacked the judiciary with a lot of hard right wing people whose dedication to the top super rich is unquestionable. So I don't think he's been a failure in everything. Yeah, you know, he got a painful surprise in Iraq. He thought it was going to be a quick, easy victory, and it hasn't been. But the prolongation of that war itself has helped him. It gave him a perfect excuse to roll back our individual rights, to set up all sorts of homeland security programs that are designed to round us up should the right emergency occur. He pushed through the Patriot Act, which is a horrible challenge to the Constitution, and one could just go on with all sorts of things as to what he's been doing.
Michael, I agree with you right down the line, absolutely. I mean, he has achieved mightily for the power interests in this country.
Mm-hmm.
With one proviso about that, he has created the level of greed. I think got so extreme that the outcome was a bubble popping nightmare that I think is much greater than anybody anticipated. I think a lot of this crisis was manufactured, literally manufactured, because what better opportunity is there for the giant corporations to be able to pick up valued assets for pennies on the dollar? And this has been a practice that's gone on in prior years, the so-called 1997 Asian contagion that was also manufactured, and it gave U.S. corporations an entree to buy up assets that those countries never wanted to sell to foreigners like us. Well, mm-hmm. we got in the end, and we made wonderful vulture investments cheap, and I think the idea was to do it again this time on a bigger scale. But I have a feeling that they overplayed their hand.
Yeah, it's gotten out of hand, though. It's in free fall right now. They're really worried that the market hasn't hit bottom, and there may not be a bottom. and that's it. But you're right, yeah. But you know, you could even extend that even further. And I've said that, I've written about that many years ago, that recessions are not necessarily a bad thing for all sectors of business. I mean, recessions often allow big capital to crowd out small capital. A recession allows big capital to buy up other assets at really garage sale prices, as you just made the point. Recessions allow for laying off and breaking labor union discipline and such. And you see, the poorer and hungrier they can make you, then the harder you'll work for less wages. You know, that's why I say, why don't Americans work for 18 cents an hour the way the Indonesians do? Is it because we're so much more self-respecting? It's because we're at a level of historical struggle where we don't have to live like that. We did around the end of the 19th century, where mass unemployment, mass poverty, and the like, and that we've had centuries of struggle to better our lives, and a lot of that is being rolled back right now by the purveyors of this corporate capitalism. And I want to emphasize corporate capitalism. When we talk about this, I'm not talking about small businesses, mom-and-pop ownerships or co-ops or things like that, which, you know, they're just the squirrels dancing among the elephants.
Indeed.
And squirrels dancing among elephants have a very low life expectancy.
I was part of a small mom-and-pop business, Michael, mm-hmm. and we certainly did not operate the way the big guys do. If we got in trouble, there was nobody to funnel us some
no
money to keep us going. We discovered, Michael, I like to say that we discovered that when we didn't need them, the bankers loved us. And when we did need them, they didn't return phone calls.
When you're
a private company, you're not on Wall Street and you're tiny, you don't play by the same rules as the big guys. We also
Tell me, explain for your listeners the latter one. When you didn't need them, they wouldn't return phone calls. Why wouldn't they be interested if you were looking for a loan that you really needed very much?
Oh, exactly. We had a line of credit, and if we didn't need it, it was always there for us. We were in a very cyclical business, and we went through some very severe bumps a few times. And during those bumps,
You were too risky. They wouldn't want to lend you money.
Oh, absolutely. That's exactly right. They wouldn't touch us for fear that they wouldn't be repaid. The same reason that the banks are very careful about not wanting to lend now. Who wants to lend to somebody who won't repay you? So
And giving them billions out of the public treasury from the U.S. taxpayer doesn't solve the problem, because that's not what the problem is. They got money. They've got money to lend if they want to lend it. They don't particularly want to lend it.
We never got any corporate welfare.
Yeah.
we were not in the queue to be a recipient of any of that. So we literally we're free market capitalism, Michael. We either made it or we sank.
Yeah,
we nearly sank a couple of times.
Well, that's what it is. It's state welfare, corporate welfare for the big companies, and it's a rugged free enterprise, free market for the small individual company, or even self-employed people like myself. I mean, I live now off my lecturing and my writing. I mean, if I have a lean year, I don't get any subsidy. I don't see the federal government saying, "Hey, we're going to bail you out. You know, take care of you." In fact, I'm one of the bailouts. As a taxpayer, I'm one of the people who's bailing out those people up at the top.
It's a terrible
system where even their crises, they turn into an opportunity for further plunder of the public. And that's the thing about a corporate concentrated wealth like that, is it becomes a self-devouring system that is, you see, the function of the state is to protect the big corporate interests and their process of profit and capital accumulation. The other function that the state has, though, and this is often not looked at by people on the left or the right, the other function of the state is to protect the corporate money system from itself, because it's a self-devouring beast. It eats itself up, you know, Steve. I mean, Ken Lay, Enron, you know, Regal, WorldCom, Halliburton. I mean, they they had to take actions against them. I mean, Ken Lay took a viable corporation that employed 5,000 people and plundered it. He just stole their money, stole their pension, stole it all, wiped out. These people ended up losing their savings in the company, which they've been forced to invest in at unrealistic prices, and lost their jobs too. So that Ken Lay and his friends, Bernie Ebers and the others, and all they just plundered, and unless they're reined in, they will devour their own system. Look what happened in Argentina in the 1990s. That's exactly what they did.
Exactly. And the only reason these people got caught is their crimes were so great you couldn't cover them up.
Right.
So they got hung on their own petard. We need to take another break, Michael, and we'll be right back.
This is Cascadia Public Radio.
Welcome back to the News Hour. I'm Steve Lindeman. I'm on with Michael Parenti. Bottom of the hour, Michael, we'll hear the band strike up again. One quick comment. During the first 2 years of Bush's first term, we had the corporate scandals you were talking about. A fair number of companies, I mentioned them in an article I'm going to put out in about a month or so. I wanted to do a recap of the 8 years under George Bush, and my God, I think you need at least a book to cover it, but a long article will have to do. So it began with the corporate scandals in years one and two of his administration, and now we're closing out his second term, and we're addressing possibly the worst financial/economic crisis in the history of the world. There's no telling how bad this may get before it finally settles down, but this is a calamitous situation, and I think the powers that be are grudgingly coming around publicly to admit that this thing is worse than they thought, and that when will they finally admit that this is something that maybe they can't even handle?
Well, that's maybe expecting too much. They treat it like it's not of their own making, too, that it's something that's descended on us, sort of, like an earthquake or a tornado or something like that. Do you know what I mean? It's a natural force. They talk about the market is in a crisis, as if the market were actually a conscious entity that did these things, a large, big beast that somehow was in bad temper now, or ill now, and needing to get healthy again.
None of this should have happened, Michael. As you know, it none of it should have happened. It's excess writ large. These people brew this terrible stew that we're all forced to suffer under. And Michelle Chosudovsky, his latest article he put up on Global Research on Saturday, he calls the current situation the Great Depression of the 21st century, collapse of the real economy. It's a pretty startling article. I urge everybody to read it.
Mm-hmm. Well, definitely, I will read it, and I haven't yet. I think Barack Obama, of course, has been handed something. I hear among conservatives that this might be a good election to lose. This might have been a good election to lose, like give this incredible mess over to, the liberal fellow there.
You're reading my mind.
And of course, that's what they've done. They're giving him this mess. I mean, there are all sorts of people are calling up the Great Depression and FDR. Well, one thing, FDR didn't have $11 trillion debt hanging over his head, which itself, just to try to service a debt like that, could wipe out your budget. I mean, this is why conservatives pursue a lot of debt spending. I mean, the biggest debt pump-up was under Ronald Reagan. When Reagan came into office, the U.S. national debt was $800 billion dollars. When he left office, it was over $2.5 trillion. Well, proportionally, that's a higher increase of debt than even George W. Bush did. I mean, just percentage wise. Herbert Walker Bush Senior, he came into office and he pumped up that debt from two and a half to close to $5 trillion. He doubled it. And then his son did the same thing. He doubled it from $5 trillion to $10 trillion. And now with this $700 billion giveaway and this last budget, which has almost got a $1 trillion deficit, it might be closer to $12 trillion. Now, the bigger your debt, the less does your tax dollar go to helping you or your society. It's a way of privatizing the federal budget. The bigger your debt, the larger is the chunk of every tax dollar goes to pay off rich private creditors rather than being used for human services or whatever else you might need it for. So these conservatives have found a great way to undermine the social democracy. Any trace of social democracy that we might have had is by simply piling up debt after debt. What they do then is they borrow, in effect, they borrow money from the people they should be taxing. They cut their taxes off. Corporations pay very little taxes now. Banks pay very little taxes. The super rich pay very little taxes. And instead, they just borrow money from them. And rather than paying taxes, the super rich creditors are making money off the public budget.
Indeed they are, and the numbers are really staggering. The national debt is so great that it is absolutely impossible to repay this debt. And I've quoted people in some of the articles that I've written, Michael. They talk about some frightening things that may happen sooner than most people would think. Whether they will or not, I have no idea. But talking about everything from a very large devaluation of the dollar, something on the order of creating a new dollar to replace the current one on something like a 12-to-1 ratio. So you'd need 12 of the new ones to replace the one that you have now. And others.
No, the other way around. You need 12 of your dollars now to buy one of the new ones. Is that what you mean?
To
get one of the new dollars or something.
Well, your current dollar would only be worth 1/12 as much.
Yes.
You're listening to the Republic Broadcasting Network. Because you can handle the truth.
Welcome back to the News Hour. I'm Steve Linneman. I'm on with Michael Parenti. The other nightmare scenario, Michael, that we got cut off on was a complete defaulting on our obligations. Literally, I guess, the bankruptcy of the country, and we simply walk away from all of our debts and the dollar. And that's beyond my capacity to understand. If that happened, I don't quite understand what that would mean. Does that mean that everything we have in our wallets and in our checking account is worthless? I don't know.
Well, usually they say inflation is the opposite of depression, that during depression and recession there's, you know, the dollar deflates, but we saw in the Weimar Republic in Germany that with the Great Depression, there did come then an inflation that the mark itself became worthless. So when the real economy begins to crumble, the financial puffed up world collapses like a balloon with no air left in it or something. And that's what seems to be happening, but it remains to be seen. Yeah.
What can the president-elect do when he comes into office? What do you see from him?
If we really mobilized around him, I mean, you know, the his opponents are already talking about we're afraid of him, and he may go crazy, blah blah blah, and they're already trying to undermine. They're continuing the McCain campaign, which is to hit him with every day with a new fear or a new negative thing or something. He could do a lot of things. He could, for instance, end both those wars. He would then, right there, save, about $50 billion a week, a month, anyway, or more, he'd have. He could reinstitute or not renew the estate's tax suspension. That would bring him hundreds of billions of dollars. He could cut the waste from the defense budget and cut much of that budget, stop the planting more and more nuclear missiles all around. Putting those missiles in Poland is a provocation that's really bringing us back to the days of the Cuban Missile Crisis. And that would save, the money being spent and wasted in the defense budget. So, right there, he could have $1 trillion, or certainly hundreds of billions of dollars. He can stop all the multi-billion-dollar giveaways for these banks to buy up other banks. That's not really helping the economy. And then the money he spends, he could spend it from the bottom up. I mean, you could revitalize the economy from the bottom up, not from the top down. I mean, if you give a CEO a $50 million retirement bonus, right? Well, this guy has more money than he knows what to do with. So what does he do? He just salts it away in some treasuries or something. I mean, it doesn't go anywhere. It has a depressive effect. If you gave that $50 million to all of his employees who were getting their benefits cut and everything else happening, that means each employee would get maybe $7,000. Well, that $7,000 would be spent immediately on the kid's dentist bill. There's no dental insurance in America, so your kid is hurting with his teeth. Now you can go and help him or buy the new refrigerator because the other one keeps breaking down and it seems to be unable to be repaired or fix up something or clothes or shoes or food or whatever, all of which immediately has a multiplier effect on the economy and would bring vitalization. I mean, there's nothing really all that wrong with the real economy, you know. People want to eat and they want to work and they want to be able to earn money and they want to be able to spend it. They need to spend it. So the way they're doing it right now is very regressive. So that might be one of the first things that Obama should be doing. Unfortunately, he doesn't seem to really be striking out new ground in that direction.
I think a good reason why is where his money has come from. One of his biggest sources, Michael, has come from Wall Street. It's inconceivable that he will do anything to bite that hand. So Wall Street is a great recipient of all of this treasury largesse coming from our pockets. I like to think of it as the U.S. Treasury having been privatized, and it's being systematically looted to reward these criminals that caused this crisis in the first place. And they elected Obama. I agree.
Steve, let me just break in. You know, why own only one political party when you can own two?
Oh, they own them both.
Rupert Murdoch did that. He gave money to Hillary Clinton, and he's backing her. And he did that in England too. He gave money to Tony Blair along with the Tories and Labor, the new so-called New Labor Party. It becomes very, very simple. They buy up everybody, it seems.
Oh, absolutely. Well, you know the way Gore Vidal characterized the party. So we have a one-party state with two wings.
That's right, yeah.
I think he calls it either the property party or the money party.
Well, people always say we need a third party. We really need a viable, real third party. And then someone always gets up and says, we need a second party.
We need a second party,
yeah.
Indeed.
So, although, you see, there are enough differences that do make a difference. I mean, the Republican Party is now, at present, in the hands of the most reactionary retrograde element within that party. And they really are out to wipe out Social Security, wipe out disability insurance, survivor's insurance, unemployment insurance, public education, and they're doing a good job on public education of privatizing it. What you do is you defund a program, and then you say, you see, it doesn't work. You don't give them money, and then, of course, then it doesn't work. They never do that with the Pentagon, of course. They just keep giving them more and more and more money. So there are some differences. There are some marginal things, and we can't dismiss all of that out of hand. A lot of time you can say, well, do the differences really make a difference? And the answer is a resounding no. But there are some programs where there is a difference. And it's on those things, that's how Obama is able to capture the vote of the needy and of the youth and of the others who, you know, clinging to some hope that there'll be people who will start changing things. So far, the people he's selecting do not promise any new and bold paths. I mean, you get Madeleine Albright or Rahm Emanuel or something. I mean, you're not really breaking new ground and opening up new visions.
And these are the names that are being floated to have the key posts in the Obama administration. And imagine a Secretary of State like Hillary Clinton, who is so hawkish. She is very scary. I think she competes with John McCain on who could be the scariest. Who would be the first to send off the bombers and the missiles to go attack whichever country they want to be the next target? Shall it be Iran this week? Maybe it'll be Russia next week. It really scares me. And for Obama to have people like Zbigniew Brzezinski as a key foreign policy advisor, I think he sees Russia as the great rival. And he sees Iraq as a distraction. Why worry about Iraq? I mean, we have a real challenger out there in Russia. And, of course, they have all of those missiles and nuclear weapons and so on. And, of course, the country is so mammoth. And on top of it, they have all those wonderful resources that we want to get our hands on, all of that oil and all the rest. And who knows what they haven't found in this vast amount of territory that we call Russia. Huge country.
Yes.
What, 7, 11, I forget how many time zones it has. A dozen time zones or so?
It has exactly 12 time zones, yeah.
Incredible. Absolutely incredible.
Well, and then there's also seeing China as a potential enemy and all that and the like, and maybe someday India and so forth. You see, it's a view of the world where anybody's prosperity or well-being or development becomes a threat to you. And the implication is, or the conclusion is, that you want a world where everybody is weak and poor and fractured and prostrate, you know, and we and only we are powerful. I want a world where there are other successful nations and countries. That means they have good economies, that means they'll trade, that means they'll buy. That means we'll get along. I don't. This mentality that if a country begins to show any kind of self-sufficiency and charts its own path, then that country's a potential threat. That was the problem with Iraq. You know, Iraq was Washington's poster boy, Saddam Hussein, when he was killing all the Democrats and dissidents and doing what the CIA wanted. Or boy, he was. They couldn't do enough for him. They gave him money. They gave him guns. They gave him aid. All that. It's only when he proved then that now he had his country. He wanted to rule it independently of Washington. He wanted to sell more oil. He didn't want to confine it to the oil quotas they were sticking him with, which really cut his earnings down. He kept a public, state-owned economy. He actually kept some of the programs of the previous democratic regime that was in there, including public education and public health and all. So they suddenly said, hey, wait a minute, this isn't our free market, client state comprador leader. He's going into business for himself. So suddenly he was branded as another Hitler and a danger to America and supports Al-Qaeda and a terrorist and all that. And so these U.S. leaders went in and murdered and destroyed the lives of hundreds of thousands of Iraqi innocent men, women, and children. pursue their interests, make the world safe for the corporate 500.
Oh, exactly. And, of course, the same thing in Iran. We literally don't care whether mullahs, crazy or otherwise, run the country, and I'm not suggesting that they're crazy. We don't care about that. We only care whether they toe the mark to us or whether they decide that they have the audacious thought, Michael, that they have a right to run their own country, and they don't have to get approval from Washington to do it. And the same thing with Hugo Chavez in Venezuela, Jean-Bertrand Aristide in Haiti, where the Marines came in one night and escorted him out of the country. And then, and then the official line was that he offered to leave. Well, he didn't offer to leave. At the barrel of a gun, he didn't really have much choice.
Right.
I mean, these terrible things that go on, and it could happen to a Democrat or a despot. And the only issue is, will they obey us or will they not obey us?
Mm-hmm. Right. It's a kind of mafia foreign policy.
Ah, the ultimate godfather, right?
Yeah.
Well, I'm worried about
right.
Obama, and I'm worried that we may end up. We need to do all we can to prevent it, but I'm worried that we'll end up with a seamless transition from Bush to Obama, and there may be some changes around the edges. But the basic codline policy, catering to Wall Street, illegal foreign wars, maintenance of the repressive police state laws, not much relief on social services, that this stuff will continue to go on and we won't see much of a change. I'm really concerned about that.
Well, Steve, this is where we have to do what Antonio Gramsci advised.
Indeed.
Which is, you have a pessimism of the mind, which is what you just spelled out, all the possible dangers and things, but an optimism of the will. So there's no reason to say it's inevitably that way. There is a window of opportunity here, and he's already did say he's definitely, unequivocally, he said he's going to close down the Guantanamo prison. He's closing it down, period. And he's already talked about rolling back some of Bush's emergency laws, which seem to come right out of the Third Reich, you know. So you know, let's also act, let's mobilize our forces and see what we can get and push and how far we can push.
I agree with you 100% on the spirit. It's the reason I'm on this program. It's the reason that I write. It's the reason you do everything you do. And I urge people all the time to think the same way. I like to say, Michael, that I'm in the recruiting business, which was really my small family business. We ran job fairs, and we began working with young military officers leaving the service back in the 1960s. But I like to say I'm still in the recruiting business, recruiting people to do the kind of things that we're talking about right now. We have to hold their feet to the fire.
Mm-hmm. Good. Well, I think we've just about covered everything, Steve. What are we going to do for the next couple of minutes here?
Well, I want to keep you on as long as you're able, and if we've reached the end of important things that you want to say, then I can let you go. What should we do? Anything else that is on your mind, Michael?
Well, could I direct your listeners to my website?
Oh, absolutely.
It's www.michaelparenti.org, O-R-G. And Michael Parenti is one word. Parenti is spelled parent with an I at the end. So,
well, I imagine if they just Google your name, they're going to find your website.
Yeah, that's the first one. Michael Parenti's Political Archives, I think it's called.
And it's got all your books.
It's got all the books, articles, speaking engagements, excerpts. Not all the articles, but there's about 10 or 15 articles in full, which you can read. And also tapes and DVDs and all that are for sale through TUC Radio. But they've got a link. They've got, there's, in the website, there's titles and descriptions of available talks.
Well, I swear by it. I don't get a chance to listen to you or to be there when you talk, but I can't recommend your books more highly because I've been reading them for years. And I've read about 15. They're all on my shelves.
Oh, bless you, Steve. Bless you.
Oh, well, and Democracy for the Few twice, because the 8th edition came out, and I got hold of it, and I read it, and I wrote a little bit about it, you may recall.
Mm-hmm.
And that book alone is so important, such a classic. And, Michael, I must add also that I don't get to meet in person very many people who come on this program. In fact, just a couple. And it was a great highlight for me to come out to California and completely unexpectedly to have a chance to meet you and sit down with two other people who have been on this program, Bonnie Faulkner and Mickey Huff.
All right.
And Bonnie invited me on her program, and I reciprocated, and I invited her on my program.
Uh-huh.
So she came on.
You both do terrific, good work. And your advertisers, by the way, are very interesting, too. I love listening to those ads. I was jotting down a few numbers here.
You want to stick around for a few more minutes?
Sure.
Okay, we'll take a final break and then finish up the hour. Welcome back to the News Hour. I'm on with Michael Parenti. Michael, you mentioned earlier that the possibility, I think it's a very strong likelihood, that the Republicans were very eager to hand over the mantle to the Democrats to let them deal with the mess that they made. And I suggested this in an article that I wrote back in July. I didn't know, but I really believe that's exactly what they did. And I compared it to 1976 when the Rockefellers picked Jimmy Carter to be the next president.
Mm-hmm.
And Gerald Ford, you remember the way Lyndon Johnson described Gerald Ford?
Right.
He couldn't walk and chew gum at the same time.
Right. Couldn't walk down the street and chew gum at the same time.
I think that's exactly what they did, and I think they picked a ticket designed to be hated with a guy who is roundly disliked by conservatives in his own party, plus his terrible temperament, and a woman I wouldn't want sitting on my condo board, let alone be vice president.
You mean McCain and Sarah Palin, yeah.
Aside from her outlandish views about things, I mean, she literally doesn't know much about anything. And when she was nominated, the first reaction from the AP that I quoted in an article was that she knows more about fishing than affairs of state. I found that astonishing from the AP.
Yes, she, of course, does touch certain chords. She's got that basic, that pseudo right-wing populism that isn't really. I mean, there's a populist strain on the conservative side, but she's a phony on that one. But she knows how to press some of those buttons and leave the impression that she talks for Joe the plumber and Steve the baker, and she even went down a whole line of people like that, Ted the tailor, you know. Yeah, right. Yeah, as if she has anything to do with those people.
Of course, she reads the lines that are written for her.
Yeah, but I really think that the people of America have to really call for a rolling back of the U.S. military budget. It's now over $600 billion, and then if you count on most of the Energy Department budget is also military spending. The military is the biggest user of fuel in this country. The military is the single largest polluter in the country. There are almost no regulations and restrictions upon it. It can do what it wants in terms of toxifying the environment and leaving dumps here and there of, you know, shells and such in it. We should start closing bases, not just in the U.S., but all around the world. There's no other nation in the world that has, you know, 300 military bases all over and filled with death-dealing instruments and delivering destruction in several countries right now, either directly with U.S. troops or through proxy troops. This kind of thing really should be, that's got to be stopped and rolled back. They're now thinking of moving in big into Africa. they're crazy. There's an obsession of certain Washington planners that their goal ultimately is controlling the whole world, you know. They have this They even have this thing, Pastures for Social Control. I don't know if you've seen that, where they're recruiting pastors to speak to their congregations to learn to obey the government and obey authority, as Romans 13 instructs.
My goodness.
And I've seen tapes of such sermons. I'm not imagining it.
It's obscene. If we don't figure out a way to change this, we'll go the way of all the previous empires. They went down, and we will too.
Right.
Michael, the hour flew by. It's gone.
Right.
The only time I have left is to thank you so much for coming on.
Well, thank you,
Steve. It is a great honor for me to have you on, and I thank you very deeply for it.
Well, I was grateful to be on, and thank you for all your fine work. Bye-bye.
Oh, thank you, Michael.